This is Gary Ritterstein welcoming you to the Care to Talk Show. I enjoyed hearing Jamie's story last time. I'm inspired by all the ways she continues to serve others. Before COVID-19, Alyssa and I were planning to join our first mission team to South Africa, where we would have been serving with Victory for All, which is an organization dedicated to breaking the cycle of poverty by providing education and childcare. Since it was put on hold, we'll be sponsoring one of their classes, and now that we're back in town, we'll be volunteering at NCC's Dream Center, which has collected and donated more than 25,000 pantry items and 20,000 meals with the help of more than 1,000 volunteers from the DC area. We were there just a couple weeks ago, and it was such an honor to play a small part in supporting our neighbors in need, and we plan to do it again real soon. In this episode, I care to talk more about answering the call to serve with my friend Edward Powers. He recently retired from the United States Marine Corps and works with a nonprofit Christian ministry that's spreading the gospel to the next generation. I care to talk with Edward because I have tremendous respect and admiration for those who devote their lives to serving others, including our health workers and first responders, but especially our men and women in uniform. I was in the Army JROTC program with a lot of people who went on to join the military and came pretty close to joining myself. If you don't know, JROTC is a class that educates students about the military and provides basic training in non-combat skills like CPR, land navigation, and physical fitness. In addition to learning so much about the sacrifices made by our servicemen and women over the years, I also learned some pretty hard lessons about leadership. After attending a summer training camp, I remember being thrust into a leadership role in my second year, which came with a higher rank than my peers. And I let it go to my head, assuming that higher rank entitled me to greater respect and that those who put me in charge would have my back. Well, that's not exactly how things played out. The more I tried to prove myself, the more criticism I faced. In part because I didn't do enough to build better social relationships with people. After getting passed over for some bigger roles, I finally began to appreciate how much more influence some friendships gave me than any role or rank in the program. Even though I received a congressional nomination to the West Point Military Academy at the time, I knew that I first had so much more to learn about leadership, so I joined the college ROTC program instead. 1 month into my first year in college, I was putting on my ROTC uniform, only to find out that class was canceled. When I came back, I heard a voice message from my mom telling me how a plane flew into the World Trade Center. She suddenly blurted out, "Oh my God, it looks like another one just hit. I have to call Christian." That's a cousin of mine who lives in the city. I never felt more fired up to go fight the bad guys ever before or ever since. But then another year went by, and I felt like I still wasn't getting the leadership training I needed. And I was so turned off by the politicization of the war in Iraq by our country's leaders that I shifted gears to pursue a career in media and politics. I care to talk more about that later in the show and in future episodes. Before I welcome Edward, let me give you a little bit of background about how we know each other. Just this past year, I felt called to do more with my life to help build God's kingdom on earth, and I believe more than ever before that we're entering a new season of revival. After I shared a vision of what I thought this could look like with my pastor, his staff connected me with Edward, who also attends National Community Church, because he's part of the leadership team of Together Generation. They're planning their second large-scale gathering of local church pastors on the National Mall, focused on making 2020 the year of the Bible. We hit it off right from the start, and I started volunteering to help. Then I told him about our prayer to buy our first home, and he connected me with his wife, Mary, who's a realtor. And just a couple weeks later, God used her to answer our prayer. I think it's fitting that Edward's my guest during this time of Memorial Day when we remember our fallen heroes, because I care to talk with him in just a moment about what led him to join the Marines, what he learned from his experience, and how faith shapes who he is as well as the work that he does. Edward, thanks for joining me.
Hey, Gary. Thanks. I'm excited for the opportunity.
Why don't you start by telling the two-minute version of your life story?
All right. So I grew up in a family much like you would have seen on Leave It to Beaver, if you're of the generation that watched that. I was blessed with great parents that are still together to this day, celebrating their 50-year anniversary. And they introduced me to Christ, you know, when I was very young. You know, blue-collar workers, both of them, and they raised me, you know, to work hard, and they raised me, you know, to be just a principled man of character is what they would call it. So as I was going into college, I met my wife, Mary, who's a we will celebrate our 27th wedding anniversary here shortly. Thank you for that. And that was, you know, really the place I thought I would be. That's where I wanted to be when I grew up. I wanted to be married and have a family. And that's kind of where I thought. But I realized, you know, at 19, being married, there was more to do in life. So I went to college. I studied literature. She studied education. Graduated from college, started teaching for a while, and I just realized, gosh, hadn't slain any dragons. And for a literature major, being married with a kid on the way before slaying dragons is completely out of order for the heroic cycle, right? And so we ended up, looking at it, and together we decided that I would join the Marine Corps. So I was commissioned and spent the next 22 years as a Marine Corps Huey helicopter pilot, you know, culminating as a squadron commander, and then going on to do some staff work here in D.C. before retiring and moving on to my my next mission, as I, spend my days just making Jesus known and trying to help people, get out of their own way.
One of the things you said that as a child, you said your dad was your role model. Can you share a little more about what life was like growing up and your relationship with him?
Yeah, sure. He was my role model for good and for worse, much like all of our dads or absence of dads tends to become. But he was, he's a very disciplined person, and character was the most important thing. With that, there's also things that I learned from him that have been a challenge. We didn't talk very much. Talking, emoting was not something that you really did in the power's definition of what it was to be a man. And so, not that I have anything against my dad. I love him. He's amazing, but he's a human.
Is there a time or a memory you have that stands out in your mind where you first started to see or really saw the good qualities of him come out? And would you mind giving a little bit more detail on what were some of the challenges that he faced that you began to appreciate later on?
So my dad sat my brother and I down. One of the few times that we actually sat down and had a talk. I think I was a junior in high school when this happened. Sons, boys, I will, I just want to let you know, I will back you in whatever you choose to do in life. Unless you decide to be a correction officer. My dad was a correction officer for over 4 decades, or join the military. My dad was in the Navy for 9 years. He was in the Navy during Vietnam, and then he was a correction officer. He had several levels of drama with that bureaucracy and just, trying to maintain his character and do his job in spite of, the published rules. So he wanted to pass that wisdom on to us. However, we had watched him live his life as a correctional officer. We have the way his men admired him and followed him. And, ultimately my brother has been a correctional officer for going on, 30 years. And I just retired from the Marine Corps after 22 years. And so that was one of those experiences that I will always remember that will always settle for me, what you do and how you live your life is the most powerful way to spread your message.
You were sort of alluding to that there have been people in your life, including him, that weren't perfect. Can you put a little bit more color onto some of those things?
I think the biggest thing that I had to unlearn that I learned from my father was just this definition of what it looks like to be a man. For people like me who grew up where I did, we talked about sports. Talked about chopping wood or doing yard work or projects and things like that. It was very traditional for men to not cry, to not be sensitive and not really talk about deep stuff. What happens when you go like that is you end up becoming very judgmental, and it definitely makes it difficult to be compassionate and to act on their behalf. And so I, moved out of a very small circle, small town environment, had to wrestle with these things and go, as I went to college, I encountered many other people, groups, cultures, other points of view, other religions, other faiths. And then I, I'm realizing, man, there's everybody's trying to answer these same questions.
2 generations ago to now is like our culture's changed so much than it did 2,000 years before, because now we have the ability to communicate with so many different people in so many different ways that it sort of fits you to either feel bad or to engage and better understand. I think that's really, really important. And I mentioned at the top of the show how close I came to joining the military myself. And I'll always remember the first time I heard the pitch from a recruiter. They opened up their laptop and they had this screen and it had these 4 different color pieces about the benefits of, and one of them was financial security. The other one was education assistance. The other one was adventure training. And the other one was the prestige of honoring your country. And almost always folks I was with started with education assistance or financial security. So I was curious, what was your first puzzle piece from studying language and literature at Oregon State University to signing up for the Marine Corps?
Definitely a sense of adventure, because I spent a lot of time reading adventures, but I hadn't done much of it myself. And I remember the one question that kept going through my mind, like, how do I really know what I stand for until I get to the point where somebody says, tell me, you know, what you believe in. And, you know, I had to risk, you know, being killed by that. And that was one small example. We had to get, you have to get dog tags, you know, identity tags when you go in the military. And one of the things they'll say is there's an opportunity to put your denomination on there, your faith denomination on your dog tags. And a lot of people would say, just leave that blank, you know, because if you're captured, you're gonna have these things around your neck. And if it says Christian, you know, that things could go poorly for you. And so I made it a point, you know, to put Christian on there in all caps, because that was important to me.
What sort of prompted that discussion with your wife? How did that discussion go? What were the steps you took?
Interesting. So I finished college. We moved back to my hometown and I promptly got a job teaching at a place where the judge would say, all right, you can go to juvenile hall or you can actually get your GED and make a life for yourself. So I found myself in a place with kids that did not want to be there, but I still tried to give them opportunities. And one of the things I did is I brought in all the recruiters saying, hey, if you get your GED, here's what you can go do. In the midst of that, I was talking to them and, you know, I'm like, man, this sounds like an adventure. You know, it so happened that the Marine Corps primary recruiting commercial directly equated joining the Marine Corps to slaying dragons. And so I went and talked to my wife, talking about, you know, what it would look like, you know, even the separation, because that was really for us, you know, that was a challenge and we had to really get through that. But ultimately we decided, you know, we both liked it. You know, we were both very nomadic and moving around was something that actually was appealing to us. And so I went to officer candidate school, which is the equivalent of, you know, boot camp for officers. And then you go to a 6-month basic school, which all Marine officers go to learn how to be a platoon commander.
So you start out as an officer, you're 22 years, work your way up to lieutenant colonel. What were some of the things you had to do to work your way up?
You know, I had 3,500 hours in the UH-1 November in Yankee, which surviving 2,000 hours in the UH-1 November is a feat in and of itself, based on the nature of that aircraft from there. You know, I had the fortunate opportunity to be a weapons instructor at Fighter Weapons School for the Marine Corps. I was able to be the lead instructor for my aviation platform. And that was, you know, amazing, because basically all the squadrons send you their best pilots to be put that fine sheen and polish on them and make them, you know, weapons and tactics instructors, you know, masters of their airframe, masters of, you know, marine aviation. So being a master of that, being the best you possibly be at that, you know, and inspiring others to do the same was really, really the key. You know, and ultimately, you know, I was basically rewarded with, you know, being able to be a squadron commander, you know, and that is a very challenging duty, but yet, you know, the Marine Corps entrusts you with 27, you know, multi-million-dollar aircraft and, you know, 400 Marines made it through 4 non-combat deployments and 3 combat deployments. And so I was able to see a lot, learn a lot.
It sounds like quite a lot. You know, I want to get to what happened in 2015, because, you know, I know that had such a big impact on your life. When I asked, you know, the place you've been to that others should try, you mentioned your time in Kathmandu, Nepal. Can you give a little bit of context to what led you there, who you served with, and what your day-to-day was like?
So when I was a squadron commander, I was the commander of Marine Light Attack Helicopter Squadron 469. Our call sign was Vengeance, because our squadron was brought into the world as a result of 9/11. We deployed to the Western Pacific. You know, we did a lot of security cooperation and assistance training with other nations. We were actually in the Philippines at the end of April on a training mission. And so on April 25th, there was that massive earthquake in Nepal. It was devastating. You know, in some places, 90% of the buildings had collapsed in the villages. So, you know, they asked me if I could bring, you know, some of my helicopters to Nepal to help. So they deployed a portion of my squadron, 3 of my Huey helicopters and 65 total Marines to go to Kathmandu. And we started to basically provide, you know, humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. It was very interesting because it was a real mission. It was the most challenging flying that me or my, you know, my flight crews had ever been in. You know, the Himalayas are, I characterize them as the most beautiful, terrifying place I have ever been on Earth, because it's like creation rises up to show you, look at me, you know, I am big, I am beautiful, but you better respect me. So it's just a very intimidating, intense, very challenging flying environment. We're loading down these helicopters and going to high altitudes, high winds. But yet my crews are coming back and they're smiling. They're happy. They're telling me stories. We're seeing pictures over and over of these people that haven't had food. They haven't had shelter. They haven't had water for going on, you know, 2 weeks now because the one goat trail coming into their village slid off the mountain during the earthquake. And when you land and you bring them rice and shelter and some water purification equipment, and the looks on their faces are something that is one of the most rewarding things that I've ever seen. Be able to be in that place doing the right thing to do, counteracted, you know, how hard it was, how challenging it was, and really how scary it was at times to fly in these places.
So tell me what happened on that day.
So, you know, we were 7 days into operations. We were figuring out which village to go to, figuring out what supplies to do, and we were flying them out there. We'd fly two crews a day, and we just, you know, constantly from, you know, sunrise to sunset, we'd be out there. On that morning, an aftershock hit. Aftershocks have been happening the whole time, but this aftershock was the same magnitude as the original earthquake. A few remaining buildings started to come down. And so we're like, okay, so change of mission. Let's start evacuating casualties. So I told my aircraft commanders, I said, your job from here on out is to save as many as you can. We don't know what's going on. We know they're out there. Go find them. And so they went back out. They started hitting the different locations and seeing if they were injured and bringing them back. That seemed like a good thing. You know, we've been doing this the whole time. We had already saved over 100 casualties at that point since we had been there. So later that afternoon, we lost contact with Captain Lucas Savage's aircraft. It was one of my senior aircraft commanders. His co-pilot, Captain Chris Norgren, was one of our up-and-coming, you know, stars. I did two of my weapons and tactics instructor crew chiefs. You know, so they'd been at that same school where I was. So they were the cream of the crop, Sergeant Ward Johnson, Sergeant Eric Seaman. And then I had two folks from combat camera that were kind of documenting what was going on with us, you know, Corporal Sarah Medina and Last Corporal Jacob Hug, and we lost contact with them. Initially, we're like, okay, well, he's probably down in the valley somewhere. But, you know, time crept on. We started getting some sporadic reports about distress calls, starting to get nervous. You know, time keeps clicking. He's overdue now. Weather is starting to come in. So I'm like, okay, what? You know, maybe he landed somewhere to wait out the weather. Maybe he ran out of gas. Maybe you know, and he's sitting in an LZ, you know, waiting for gas. Maybe his aircraft broke down and he did a precautionary landing somewhere. And so I have to make this decision, right? Do I declare this aircraft missing? It doesn't happen very often, you know, and I don't know what's happened to them. And I remember I was standing, we were in a tent, you know, at Kathmandu Airfield. And so I just, everybody's looking at me. It's crazy. The radios are going crazy. And I'm like, give me a minute, guys. And I walked outside and I'm just, everything's going through my head. I just stopped and said, Lord, what do I do in this space? Because I have no idea what to do. And then, you know, it just came to me, just my job is to praise you right now in this storm. And I think about the song that says the same thing. So I just started rattling off things I was thankful for. I'm like, I'm thankful my other aircraft safe on deck. I'm thankful for the, you know, the guys being able to help these people. I'm thankful for my family. I was just rattling these things off. And all of a sudden this peace like settles over on me. And it became very clear to me, like, okay, these people are missing. We need to get them the aid that they can get. We need to do what we can. I moved from there and went into 3 days of search and rescue, which culminated in you know, us actually finding the wreckage, which was a blessing in and of itself when you're searching for something in the Himalayan mountains, and finding out that those six crew members, the two Nepali soldiers that were on board with us, and then five injured civilians had perished in the crash.
Gosh, man, it's tragic and saddening and at the same time awe-inspiring, because it's like, thank God for them, people who signed up for service, you know, to help people who are just desperate. It's incredibly moving.
Sure, you know, and it's, you know, it's Memorial Day. So this is one of the things, sure, you know, with the fifth anniversary of the incident and being Memorial Day, something that has been deep on my mind.
Were you able to identify or cause their crash?
Yeah. You know, weeks later, we found out that basically what had happened is they were in a small village there where there was a bunch of casualties. They had scooped them up. And so he made the decision to go direct towards Kathmandu, you know, because he wanted to get them to the hospital as quickly as he could, which took him over about a 12,000 foot peak. And that climbs you up toward the weather, where the weather's building. And in the midst of doing that, you know, the weather closed in on him. Ultimately, they lost reference to the ground and they lost reference, period. They were engulfed in clouds and run into the side of that mountain.
I told you I was going to ask is, what did you or what would you say to the families who lost loved ones, but, you know, I guess to any family who loses a loved one, about why their loved one's service was worth their sacrifice?
And I did, in fact, have to address all their families. I gave, I think, a total of 8 eulogies. And, ultimately, what I learned in Nepal and what they taught me in Nepal through their sacrifices is there are things, worth dying for. And they were all combat veterans, all done great things, all were, had medals hanging off their chest. And then they all, to a man, to a woman, admitted that this was the greatest mission that they had ever done, because they were serving those, that couldn't help themselves. And, John 15 just continued to resonate in my mind. There's no greater sacrifice that you can make for a man than to give your life mm-hmm. for another. And, and that's what I told their family. I think that's where they get their comfort, because they didn't die in vain. We saved right. countless lives in our time, in our 7 days there, and these people were willing to do it like, military service members are every day.
Going back, I feel like, when you joined the military, this is pre-9/11, then we have, we had some attacks, of course, but then you go through 9/11, terrorism is major, major threat. Fast forward just a bit to, you recently concluded your time with fellowship at the U.S. Institute of Peace, where you wrote a brief on the role of partnerships between the military and civil society organizations. And yeah. in it, you said the threat of violent extremism is greater than it was on 9/11, in part because not enough was being done to deal with what you describe as the drivers of violent extremism. Sure. So I was curious to know, what are some of the examples of those drivers? And in your view, what are some ways to better deal with them? And why hasn't that been happening yet?
Yeah, that is a fantastic question. And it was a weird place to be as a Marine Huey pilot, at the Institute of Peace. But talking about drivers, really what it comes down to is context. And we touched on a little bit earlier about, empathy and its relationship to compassionate action. So behind every act, there is some sort of thing that happened in the life that led to a perception of, injustice that kind of put them down this path. And then those grievances can be reinforced, and you can continue to cement them into someone's mind, or, you could allow them to see that grievance is not, legitimate, and then they would, change their path from there. But it's one of the things we do as humans is once that you have a belief in place, then your mind is by default going to search all of your experience for evidence to support that belief. As a terrorist, if something happened and you saw something when you were young, you saw somebody die traumatically, you saw people starving, and you believed that the reason for that was tied to some group, and then as you grow up, you continue to build and look for other pieces of evidence to, to continue to demonize, that group, you can find that there is going to be, a resulting action. At some point, the person is going to snap, they're going to feel trapped, and they're going to act out. But, the challenge is, if you can empathetically approach a group, which is hard with some of these very violent groups, if you can try to figure out what those grievances are behind these actions, then you can start to act to alleviate those things that are typically cultural, they're governed by, nation states, governed by, climactics in the different areas, as climate changes, as herds migrate, there's all different sorts of things that can affect it. But if you can get to those root causes, then you can start making decisions that will minimize the number of people that will go down these paths.
How do you do that? And why isn't that being done more?
We're in a place in our world where we can't say anything is right or wrong, because there's no common ground of truth. And we see this in, media, whether you Google something and you can get 10 different answers to the same question, from there, there's no source of truth that people can rely on. And when there's no source of truth, there's no common ground. And it's really hard to have any discussion about what the right path or, who's right or who's wrong and how I should, ultimately how I should behave, which is what we're talking here. We're talking about, what would drive people to act out. And so that's what constantly brings me back to Jesus, constantly brings me back to the message of, Christianity at its core, which is, love your neighbor as yourself. That's, once we demonize, once we make somebody evil, once we label them, then it's very difficult, to see them as yourself. If we can look at these people, other images of God, and go, how can I build a relationship with that other, you know, image of God? They've got the Spirit of God in them, just like I do. They're as of much worth to creation as I am. How can I establish a connection there, a relationship? It's going to be by figuring out how they see things, how you see things, and then starting from that common ground, that, and moving outwards.
You know, now in light of COVID-19 and pandemic, how has your view about what some of the greatest threats we face changed?
Yeah, so I think there is a connection here, and I don't know how well I'll be able to articulate it, but one of the amazing things I think about a global pandemic is, you know, the gift that we can find in a horrible thing like a pandemic is the fact that it is common ground for all of humanity. A virus attacks, you know, all of humanity equally. And so it's something that every human can now go, I understand, you know, the dangers of this, and I would be encouraged to work together with you against this, you know, this common threat, which is not another person. And I think that's the key, is this, when the threat is another person, another group of people, then there's no way you're ever going to be able to reconcile those people and build a relationship.
In other words, it's not something you can shoot.
Exactly right. And that makes you feel really hopeless, right? I mean, think about what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. We had the most technologically advanced, most powerful military in the world in history, and we were being defeated by improvised explosive devices. You can't shoot back at them. So what you do, you look to the person at your right and left, and you forge ahead, you know, towards, you know, whatever outcome you're seeking. And I think that's, you know, as humanity, that's what we need to do. And one of the things one of the reasons that I separated from the Marine Corps, because as long as I was in the military, you know, I was able to serve my nation, and I'm proud of that. And that is an important thing to do. But there's a higher calling for me, and that's serving humanity. And the challenge with being in the military is, and ultimately, if humanity is your goal, then you can't designate other groups of people enemy. And so I decided it was time to shift from serving my nation to serving humanity at large. The same thing I told my two aircraft commanders that day, I'm like, save as many as you can. And that's not save like people think, like convert them to Christianity. That's not what I'm talking about here. It's like, and to me, that is, you know, who is my neighbor? Who lives next door? Who do I run into when I'm jogging? Who do I run into at the supermarket? Who are the people that need to see somebody living a life like Jesus? Because that's the only way that we can have an impact where people are acting compassionate towards others.
Which led you to Pulse. Sure. Can you talk a little bit about how that happened, what you do for them, and why that's important to you?
Yeah. In the course of my searching for a place where I could be most effective and I could be of most help, I met some folks, the folks at Pulse, who put on the Together events. You know, there had been two massive gatherings that were just rallying, you know, the rising generations around the name of Jesus, moving them into discipleship. I had been a part of those gatherings. And so as they're one of the organizations I reached out to, and they needed somebody here in the DMV, the DC, Maryland, Virginia area, to be to lead a team to get the word out about the Together 2020 event, which right now has been postponed to September 5th. It's going to be on Labor Day weekend due to what's going on. You know, my job was to, you know, get out to the church and, you know, and empower them and bring them together to empower, to celebrate, and to equip people, you know, to make Jesus known. And Pulse's mission is make Jesus known. And historically, they've done it through large-scale events. Recently, we've done it through, you know, massive digital events, just getting the word out about what it looks like to live like Jesus.
You're someone who, you have this, you've worked in the military, you've worked for a Christian organization, faith has been a part of your life, and here you're planning for this event in our nation's capital. We're heading into an election year. Right. So here's a hypothetical situation. You got at the table a young leftist who is actively involved in different international causes, but isn't really turned on by the church for one reason or another. Also at the table, maybe a young conservative, plugged into their church's Bible studies, but hasn't really been part of, you know, an international mission trip per se. What do you say to both of them in terms of what revival means to you?
That's a That's the challenge right now that we all fall into. And then for these two people, the first thing I would do is I would listen to them and I would kind of figure out where they were. And I would try to find, you know, that common grain of humanity. If they couldn't find one, then I would, you know, talk to them about, you know, where they are, what are their anxieties, what are their challenges in life, their real challenges in life, not their, you know, their platform or their issues that they argue about, but what is their, you know, their biggest challenge? What's big enough that we could all go after it together? And then I would want them to know, you know, that they're not an accident, that they, you know, they're here by the gift of creation. And that, you know, with that comes, you know, some responsibility, you know, to help others to understand that and to free them from the burdens and the layers of challenge that we put on each other. I would share with them, you know, what has allowed me to operate in freedom. And that is, you know, understanding that the Creator in Jesus set the example of a way to live that is free from these anxieties that we have ingrained in our culture. I would try to capture the compassion and action, as you described it, of that leftist with the head knowledge and belief, you know, that you talk about, you know, the conservative person, and say, you know, that it's both, you know, it's justice and mercy.
One of the things that, you know, you sort of just alluded to that is, you know, bringing together that sense of justice and compassion with the sense of faith. And I mm-hmm. almost think they're separately, they're valuable, but together they're even more valuable because it's when right. you have that anointing of the Holy Spirit on top of that act of kindness, I think it can have an amplifying effect. And I know you guys yeah. are always out there trying to lift other people up. Right. So I know it's not just something you say, it's something you all do. And only of you do you inspire us to do more, but I look forward to, you know, helping with all this, you know, together 2020 stuff, but even just right. walking alongside of, you know, you and others who've been part of our lives, especially coming out of the season that we're in.
So I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this, you know, and I think, you know, we all have this potential to be that catalytic spark that shifts another person's focus out of that, you know, out of that self-focused, anxious place to an other-focused, you know, place where you can really contribute, you know, and I think that's where we find ourselves, experience peace and joy.
That's awesome. First, I want to, you know, thank you for serving our country. Also, thank you for just serving the kingdom and for sharing your story. Where can people want to get more involved and take some next steps to be part of, you know, building God's kingdom, you know, particularly with Together 2020?
Sure. I'll give you three things. So the Together 2020, the event will be on September 5th. It's going to be on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, whether that's in person or whether that's a simulcast. You can learn about that at togethergeneration.com. This coming Saturday, during the time of Pentecost, we're going to have a training. It's called Make Jesus Known. It's going to be a kind of a dual-faceted training to train people, you know, how to share this message that I've been talking about you know, living like Jesus. But then it's also going to be a tribute to one of our longtime partners who recently passed, Ravi Zacharias. You know, it's going to be a tribute to the work that he did to help people, you know, see Jesus. And you can find out about that, you know, at pulsemovement.com/makejesusknown. And then, you know, if you're just interested in talking more about the things I talked about, if you're interested in, you know, coaching and kind of getting out of your own way, you can always reach out to me at my email, which is edward@braveneighbor.com.
Awesome. Well, this has been great. I think the way you tell your story and the lessons you've learned, I think are valuable for all of us. And I hope to keep learning more of them from you.
Oh, same. Same here. I love these conversations, Gary.
I hope hearing from Edward had as much of an effect on you as it did on me. I don't automatically presume that everyone who's worn a uniform is always more selfless, more knowledgeable, or more faithful than anyone else, but I do believe that we owe each of them our respect and our gratitude for being willing to sacrifice their mental and physical health, as well as their lives, for the benefit of others. And I believe we honor that sacrifice, especially as we get through this pandemic, by making more of our own sacrifices ourselves for the greater good of humanity, as Edward put it. That might mean returning to public life wearing a mask, or it might mean sharing more with others, even when we have less. 9/11 served as a real wake-up call for our country about what happens when we worry too much about ourselves and ignore what's happening around the world. I became intrigued by the idea of leading the fight against terrorists over there so that we don't fight them over here. But I've always wondered why we don't take that same lead in fighting disease, pollution, poverty, inequality, inhumanity, and corruption. As Edward points out, these are some of the main drivers of violent extremism, which ultimately threatens our own security. And I believe this pandemic serves as another wake-up call to apply the lessons of leadership from my story, Edward's story, and yours in the post-corona world. I believe that we have come upon another historic time for choosing, not just about who will better lead us, but how we will better lead them. And that any one of our choices could make the difference between putting us on a path towards salvation and going down a road that could lead to the destruction of the world as we know it. God gives us a conscience to discern the differences in what these two paths look like. To me, that dark road is filled with lies that suggest one country or one cause or one group is more worthy than another. That we're entitled to take what we can get or excuse from giving more to others. That someone else deserves to suffer, is above the law, or beneath forgiveness. That violence is justified by fear, anger, shame, or pride, and that pursuing pleasure and power is worth any risk to health and safety. I've experienced the way God blesses each small step we take to walk according to His will, whether that's reading scripture, believing in prayer, making a donation, volunteering our time, utilizing our gifts, sharing in forgiveness, reasoning through a conflict, treading carefully, and giving God the glory. That's what invites God's spirit of peace and protection. And I encourage you to take whatever steps you can, and I welcome you to share it, along with anything else you care to talk about, by sending an email to info@caretotalkshow.com. Even though our mission trip to South Africa was postponed, we've been so inspired by those who supported us with a donation, because we set an ambitious goal of raising 50% of the funds from friends and family in 3 weeks. Then God doubled our blessing with 100% of what we needed by that time. In upcoming episodes, I care to talk more about the challenges we face and what we should do about it. Before 9/11, education was the only issue I had any experience with, because I started in a top public school, spent 2 years in a private school, and then found that I had a leg up on everyone else when I ended up in a middle of the road middle school. Not attending prep school obviously put me at a disadvantage to students from wealthier families, but eventually learned that overcoming that disadvantage is more of an exception than the rule for those who grow up in the worst performing schools. During my short stint at a DC area high school, teaching some of these disadvantaged students convinced me that we all miss out on potential opportunities when those with the most potential miss out on the best opportunities. Since then, I've given more thought to America's role in the world, the power of public policy, and whose interests may be in conflict. I remember the 2000 election because I lived in Florida, but was a year too young to vote. So I conducted a school project studying the correlation between people's policy preferences and their candidate preferences. Not surprisingly, I found that most people were like me in that their policy preferences didn't entirely line up with either side. Yet that didn't stop them from siding entirely with one candidate or the other. Perhaps like you, there's been times when I've let my political differences get the better of how I see, talk with, and treat other people. And it'll be harder to resist that temptation heading into another election. Our fellow Americans are already being harassed, spit on, assaulted, and even shot. I hope we've already learned from history about the dangers of letting our ideological differences turn into hostile conflicts. So my prayer is that we can put our conscience above our ideology in this next election, that we can find some creative ways to address each other's very valid concerns, and that we lead by example. You enjoyed listening? Then check out the other episodes, follow the Facebook page, and join me again next time if you care to talk.